This is Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I, as always, am Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Coming up in just a few minutes, we are going to continue our series of interviews with the candidates for Philadelphia mayor. Today in Studio 2, we have Rebecca Reinhart, who will make her case for why she should get Philadelphia's top spot.
Yes, and we're also talking about youth sports and unruly behavior on the sidelines. And Avi, it can get pretty crazy. We probably know, you probably know somebody, I'm sure.
I have experienced it, yes.
And we want to hear from you. Have you witnessed out of control parents on the sidelines? And what do you think about the pressure it puts on kids at such a young age? Weigh in by calling us at 888-477-9499. You can also tweet at WHYY. We use the hashtag Studio2. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
We want to start our news roundup today by going back to yesterday, Cherry. Okay. So yesterday we finished our show talking with playwright James Imes, who has a new play. It's got its world premiere right now in South Philly at Theater Exile. It's
today, called, tonight.
It's tonight. Yeah. It's called Abandon. But before that, James Imes wrote a play called Fat Ham, for which he won a Pulitzer Prize. And now, let's add a little more to the, potentially add a little more to the trophy case. So Fat Ham went on to Broadway and is now nominated for 5 Tony Awards. So we just wanted to start the show by acknowledging that and saying congratulations to James Imes.
Yeah, that's amazing. And by the way, if you've never heard of Fat Ham, which is playing in New York right now, it's a take on Shakespeare's Hamlet, and it's centered, it's modern, it's about Black queer-centered play that takes place at a cookout, and it's hilarious. He turns a tragedy into a comedy.
Into a comedy. Yeah. And it also, like Abandon, started in Philadelphia.
Yes,
and
it did.
I believe he wrote it originally for the Wilma Theater.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just cool to see a Philly play bloom into this bigger thing and getting all sorts of national love now.
Yeah. Go James.
Go James.
Go James. And so there was a big day in Harrisburg this week.
There was a lot going on in Harrisburg.
The Pennsylvania Fairness Act passed out of the House on Tuesday, 22 years after the act in its current form was first introduced. It marked a historic win for the LGBTQ community here in Pennsylvania. Now, the bill would add sexual orientation, gender identity, or expression to the state's anti-discrimination law. It passed 102-98. Two Republicans joined in the House vote there with Democrats who have a razor thin majority. And this is a pretty big deal because I don't think people knew that as it stands now, folks could still be legally fired, or it's not illegal to fire someone for their sexual orientation or gender identity. They could also be denied jobs or accommodations or housing.
And as you pointed out, look, there's no guarantee this becomes law, of course, because it has to go through the Senate, which is GOP controlled. But you referenced the long history of this. And it's a lesson for all of us that sometimes legislative change, it happens over generations. It's not one session. And we'll see what happens with this particular measure. You know, it's certainly no slam dunk to make it all the way, but
it could.
And it's staying live, I think, is the point.
Like,
you keep these things alive for long enough, they have a chance to become law.
And a bit of history, though. The first time a bill, the very first iteration of a similar bill was introduced 47 years ago. And I should mention that the governor is friendly to LGBTQ causes, so it's likely he would sign it.
Yep. And staying on politics, wanted to mention before we get to Rebecca Reinhart, another mayoral election happening May 16th, the primary election in the city of Chester. And it's a crucial election because that city, as we have talked about before on this program, is facing bankruptcy and perhaps disincorporation. The incumbent is running, Thaddeus Kirkland, he's 68 years old. Two challengers, Stefan Roots, age 62, Pat Worrell, age 63. And so a lot at stake in that election. We do not want to disregard that one, Cherry.
Yeah, and folks are sort of like pointing at the incumbent, saying time for change. But, you know, voters have a say on May 16th.
And I would say Kirkland has some accomplishments to point to as well. There's been a lot of violence reduction in Chester.
Absolutely.
So obviously the bankruptcy thing, not good. Violence reduction, you know, a legitimate accomplishment.
Yeah, and now we're going to turn to our newsmaker. Rebecca Reinhart is the former controller for the city of Philadelphia, also the former budget director and treasurer for past city administration. She is a Democratic candidate for mayor of Philadelphia. Rebecca Reinhart, welcome to Studio 2.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me today.
We mentioned your resume a little bit there. You've also been endorsed by three former mayors. But with that impressive resume and those credentials, I do think a voter might wonder, why wouldn't I just want my next mayor to appoint someone like Rebecca Reinhart to work in the administration, to help run the government? What do you bring to the front-facing role of mayor? Why would a voter want you both running the government side, the nails and the screws, but also sort of the cheerleader side of it? What do you bring to that part of the role?
Yeah, well, a successful mayor is both a cheerleader and has the ability to run the city of Philadelphia, which is a complicated entity with over 25,000 employees and a budget of close to $6 billion. So I am the only candidate running for mayor that has city executive level experience. I've run the controller's office and run it successfully for the last 5 years. The last mayor that we had that had city executive experience was Mayor Rendell. He was the district attorney, ran the DA's office before becoming mayor. What that enables me to do is hit the ground running on day one. I've gotten things done in the city system. I've maneuvered in politics to get things done. That's what I'll be able to do on day one, to make our city safer, cleaner, to fix our schools, and make our city all that it is and can be. Right? So I'm bringing that level of experience. And the buck stops with the mayor. The mayor's the one in charge, and I'll definitely bring a great team and hire a great team. But I think I'm really the right person to lead our city forward in this critical moment, because we need someone with the right experience and with courage. And I've shown that courage to take on the status quo, and we need that right now.
Yeah, so I want to point out that during your time in government, you did not have specific constituencies holding you accountable. I mean, citizens in the community calling you on a daily basis, complaining about things, pointing to you and blaming you for what was going on. And so in some ways, you were kind of separated from the needs of everyday Philadelphians. What is your plan for keeping and focusing on the human element of Philadelphia, as well as the government side of things, if you are elected mayor?
Well, actually, as city controller, I did a lot of work in the neighborhoods throughout our city, and we handled calls from people throughout the city that had issues with city services. So the controller's hotline, the calls more than doubled into that hotline with me as the city controller, because people knew that we would get things done for them on issues ranging from problems with trash to other things. And as controller, I went out to the neighborhoods. I mean, in 2019, I started doing work around gun violence. Because as a mom, as a resident of our city, I had to do something. And that's not in the traditional purview of the controller's office, which is the financial watchdog. But I reported out on what works in other cities. I worked with Councilmember Gauthier on the streets in West Philly, urging the mayor to do more. I worked with community activists on the ground, Daryl Schuler, Salam Hussein, to amplify and uplift their work. And that's the way I lead. So that's the way I'll lead as mayor, because we're only as good as how we treat every single neighborhood in our city. And that's what I'll do as mayor. Absolutely. I'll have compassion, courage, and the experience to get things done for everyone.
Let me give you a specific problem to solve. There has been reporting recently in the Inquirer about perhaps missteps in the distribution of funds to community groups meant to help stem the violence crisis we have in Philadelphia. What is the city not doing right now in how it disperses those funds that you would change? Because I know you've really built yourself as someone who understands the levers of government, how to make government work better. How can we get that money for anti-violence prevention on the community level distributed in a better way?
Well, two things. First, as mayor, I'll implement the proven intervention strategies that have been shown to work in other cities. This is group violence intervention, cure violence, cognitive behavior therapy. I've been calling on the mayor to implement those specific strategies since 2019, and I would do that as mayor. So that's first and foremost what is missing from our citywide approach to gun violence. On the distribution of funds to community groups, we do need transparency around what the particular goals are when we give money out as a city, and there needs to be metrics to measure the success of the programs that the city is giving money to, so that we can decide.
Yeah, like an example of the type of metrics, like how would you, like, sure. How would that work?
So let's say if a community-based organization was doing work in a several block radius, let's say a 10 to 15 block radius in North Philadelphia, we would have to agree on metrics with them for the number of mostly young men pulled out of that street life, level of homicide, level of shooting in that area, number of disputes between groups resolved. There's a lot of ways to actually measure, and I would look to experts. We have area universities that do this type of measurement, and that's what we need to do as a city to truly be able to measure. And then we can figure out what's working on the ground and scale that up.
I have a follow-up question on this particular point, because I've covered gun violence a long time, and this is some of the groups have been grassroots, working hard, mm-hmm. and never had really city support, and some of them need a little bit of support, sort of like making sure that they are set up correctly.
Yes,
is
yes.
that something that you would consider and implement so that, you know, that these groups that have been doing the work historically can still benefit and take on these grants and not be excluded from that funding?
Absolutely. We need to figure out a way as the city government to work with the communities, because the community groups know the most about their communities. So we need to figure out how to provide the technical support, how to provide the sort of wraparound support to the people doing good work on the ground in order to uplift them. That is something that, you know, I've seen just in working with community activists in our city in North and West Philadelphia, that there is a disconnect often that needs to be put together. And the government, we all know, you know, historically, has caused the issue of poverty in certain neighborhoods and violence through decades and decades of disinvestment and racist government policies. And so I believe that we have to be very intentional and strategic about helping the communities rebuild themselves. And that includes the good work that's being done on the ground by certain community activists.
I wish we had time for more, but we don't. Rebecca Reinhart, thank you so much for joining us here in Studio 2.
Oh, it's been great to be here. Thanks so much.
That yes. is Rebecca Reinhart. She is one of the Democratic candidates running for mayor here in Philadelphia. Now, we're going to talk about a very different type of fight. not a political fight, Sherry, but talking about the sidelines in youth sports.
Yes. Right? Have they gotten out of control? Are you one of those people? I don't know. We'll talk with two experts and we will take your comments. You can call us 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. I'm looking forward to this part.
Stick with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg. And I'm here with Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
Hello, folks.
Spring sports.
We work together. Not everyone works together.
I know, that's very true. So spring sports, Avi, is totally in full swing right now. And Little League is starting up again. And with it comes a lot of anxiety and like enthusiastic sports parents that sometimes take things too far. In fact, some parents get so worked up watching from the stands that the Deptford, New Jersey Little League is implementing a new rule that cracks down on people who yell at the umpire. Go figure.
Go figure indeed. And that's because lots of umpires and refs, Cherry, are quitting because of the abuse that gets hurled at them. Lots of youth sports programs are having trouble finding people just to officiate the games. So we wanted to step back. How did youth sports become so intense that kids, parents, and coaches are cracking under the pressure? So to help answer that question, we have two guests. First is Rick Eckstein, a Villanova sociology professor who studies youth and collegiate sports. Welcome to the program, Rick.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We also have Sky Eddy, a soccer parent, coach, and a former professional soccer player. She founded the Sideline Project, which teaches parents the best ways to support their child on the field. Welcome, Sky.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me, Avi and Cherry.
Yeah, and we want to hear from you. What do you think is wrong with youth sports? And is there a way to fix it? Our number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
I wanted to start this conversation by taking a big step back. And maybe this question sounds a little too basic. But I think I ask it because maybe we've lost sight of what the purpose of organized youth sports even is. So, Rick, let me ask you, in an ideal world, why do we even have organized youth sports? What is it supposed to provide?
Well, the ideal world, I suppose sports would provide a place where kids could build and strengthen friendships, where they could have fun, where they could enjoy an activity for its intrinsic rewards rather than some kind of extrinsic payoff down the road. So it's fun, it's friendship, it's fairness and learning how to accept graciously if you say lose a game, or to win graciously if you come out on the other end. So that's I guess what the good of all sport is, and organized sport just makes it in a kind of different way for kids potentially to enjoy themselves if they enjoy themselves.
And so, Rick, I want to ask you, how do we go from fun, friendship, and fairness to this frenzy that we are seeing on the sidelines? What has changed?
You added another F word there. That's good.
There's one we won't say, though. Yes.
Yeah, I wasn't going to go there. So I think what's happened in youth sports, based on the research that I've done, is that the stakes have become much higher. Youth sports now, at all levels, even Little League, which was holding on for the longest time to being kind of low key with volunteers and all, not part of the what we might call the pay to play industry. So now the stakes are so high, parents are thinking that sports success is going to pay off for their kids down the road, and getting them into good high schools, getting them into good colleges, and to some extent they're right, but they're exaggerating the payoff. So even when you're 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, success and failure takes on a whole other meaning, and fun and friendship kind of gets pushed to the back.
I want to bring in Sky Eddy. Sky, you played sports. You were a professional soccer player at one point. Have you noticed a change since you were a kid? And if so, what is that change on the sidelines among parents and coaches? How do you describe it to people?
Sure. It's funny. I was talking to some teammates that I grew up with not long ago, and we were remembering a couple of parents from the sidelines that were sometimes hostile or out of control. So I don't think this is necessarily a brand new issue. We've always had this a bit of a dilemma in youth sports, but absolutely to Rick's points, it's certainly becoming much more pronounced as sport has become, really performance in youth sports has become much more so about the results instead of the development of healthy behaviors, of values, and community.
I want to talk about sports culture a bit because, our studios are based in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. and, Philly is known for its fans. Is there any trickle-down effect here that, we see that sports culture is very, competitive, with players sort of talking, cross-talk on courts, on fields, and how that trickles down through parents to the kids that are on the field or on the court? And I'll start with you, Rick.
Yeah, that's a good question. That's an interesting idea. I don't know if Philadelphia is really any different than any other place. We just talk about it more and make a deal about it more. But sports fans, you know, in different cities and different places are, I think, are pretty much the same. Does that trickle down? I'm not sure. I think it's acting independently, but I think it reflects the same thing that sports is taking on at all levels now. Sports is taking on a larger than life aura. And that it means so much to so many people, even though only barely over 50% of people identify themselves as sports fans, they get a kind of exaggerated representation in the media and elsewhere. And we tend to focus on the bad behavior rather than the good behavior at the professional levels. But I think it's, rather than trickling down, I think it's reflecting just different changes in the society as a whole over the last, say, 30 years.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia. We're talking about the culture of youth sports and how it's changing with Rick Eckstein, professor of sociology at Villanova, and Sky Eddy, founder of the Sideline Project and a former pro soccer player. Sky, one of the points that you make is that there is something beyond just belligerent parent behavior that can be problematic. You talk about this idea of distracting parent or coach behavior on the sidelines. Tell us the difference between belligerent and distracting, and why distracting is also an issue.
Absolutely. I mean, I think to Rick's point about, you know, the trickle-down behaviors, like what we've failed to do, and sometimes I do think these behaviors trickle down. We haven't identified or clearly defined the culture of youth sports. And so as it's gained a lot of steam, we haven't adequately said this is what youth sports will deliver. And as we haven't identified that culture, you know, the sideline behavior has gotten out of control. And the difference for us between supportive and distracting behavior is that we believe that, and hostile behavior is that, you know, we believe if we can teach parents the difference between supportive behavior and distracting behavior being when you talk to your child when they're in the middle of participating in sport, when they're trying to facilitate a task or they're trying to think and pay attention and you're talking to them from the sidelines, that would be distracting behavior. If we can eliminate distracting behavior and help the level-headed parents understand the difference, then the sidelines will get a lot quieter. And this hostile, this belligerent behavior that we're seeing will suddenly be really a little bit more clear and will give the parents that are the level-headed sports parents a little bit of agency, a little bit of control, a little bit more power in the youth sports environment. So I'm really working to educate on the difference between supportive, distracting, and hostile behaviors. And, you know, I think education matters when it comes to changing our culture.
Yeah, I want you to dig into that a little bit more, Sky, because I want you to be specific. Because I've been I got a lot of young people in my family whose games I go to and I see and witness it. And so what should parents be doing? They're on this island. What can you describe what's distracting? Could you describe what is distracting versus what is supportive?
Sure. Supportive behavior is talking to your child or, game day, during the game day experience, applauding positive behavior at the appropriate times. So if your child makes a good play, congratulating them, congratulating the team, congratulating other teammates, it's really not being invested into the actual behaviors that are happening. So anything that's distracting is when you're talking to your child when they're in the middle of competing. So telling them to go to the ball or who to throw it into or who to inbound the ball to. What to specifically do, telling them to shoot, you know, screaming that. As parents, when we're doing that on the sidelines, what we're really doing is distracting our children from learning and from long-term cognitive growth. And in addition to that, what we're really doing is just trying to relieve our stress as parents. And so the big question is why is there stress? And what do we need to do within our culture to eliminate this stress, this frenzy of stress that is suddenly starting to permeate our sidelines and you know, take back the experience that our children deserve.
And as a follow-up, the hostile behavior will be taking it even farther, further than that.
Exactly. Hostile behavior is generally really clear. It's when we're talking to screaming at referees, screaming at players, screaming at our child, those types of things obviously are 100% unacceptable.
We are talking about youth sports culture with Rick Eckstein and Sky Eddy. If you want to join the conversation here at Studio 2, give us a call, 888-477-9499, or email us, studio2 at WHYY.org. Rick, we alluded to this earlier, but I get the sense that you feel a lot of what's rotten in youth sports starts with this idea that parents think their kids are going to get a leg up in admissions for college or get a scholarship to college through athletics. And as you point out, that's not entirely wrong. That incentive does exist. So explain what this dangling carrot is and why it is so alluring to many parents.
Well, I think it's not just getting into college, but getting into certain colleges, which imbue a certain amount of prestige, not just on the kids, but in my work I found that the parents derive a lot of their own personal prestige and status from the success of their kids, rather than, you know, reliving their failed sports days as a youth. They really generate a lot, or they accumulate a lot of kind of social capital by saying, well, my son or daughter is up at Division I athlete at such and such a school. Mm-hmm. And so it's trying to leverage not just admissions in general, but admissions to certain schools which are perceived to be elite, which the parents think is going to pay off later on to say, let's say, you know, you went to an Ivy League school rather than a state school. Whether it does pay off or not is really not clear if you look at salaries across 30 years after graduation. But as long as the parents think that's the case, they're going to do everything they can to try to get to the end of these pay-to-play youth pipelines, which is where the college coaches are all hanging out at these so-called elite tournaments and showcases. And that's the, you know, that's the interface between youth sports and college. And these admissions advantages for the last, I'd say, 8 to 10 years have really been exploding as the number of high school graduates is shrinking, and schools now are competing with each other to get students. And they're doing all kinds of things and giving all kinds of admissions advantages. And this sports pipeline and sports industry is kind of, it's already set up for the picking, but sooner or later they're just going to run out of fruit. It's just, it's a non-sustainable model. And some colleges have even folded after having 60, 70, 80% of their students as varsity athletes.
Wow. And we are speaking with Rick Eckstein, professor of sociology at Villanova, and Sky Eddy, founder of the Sideline Project and is also the soccer parent. And we're talking youth sports. If you want to weigh in, 888-477-9499 or email us at studio2@whyy.org. And we got this email from Eileen from Bala Cynwyd. Eileen says, my son is 6 years old, and in his current league, they can't find referees because parents yell at them so frequently. I have seen parents yell instructions at their 5- and 6-year-olds during practice instead of letting the coach do so. And I recently confronted a father about his yelling at his son because I found it very disturbing and uncomfortable. The pressure these kids face is too much. I want to jump to you, Sky, and talk about the kids' perspective of this, because we see parents trying to get their kids in college, and these are 5- and 6-year-olds. Mm-hmm. Talk about kids, their development, and what putting this type of pressure on them and seeing parents act like this from the sideline, what does that do?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, our children, we have a large dropout of youth sports at various ages. A lot of that is because of the innate pressure that we're putting on children from these adult-created environments that we're imposing on them. Our children are dropping out of youth sport with anxiety issues, identity issues, all because of this high-stakes environment that we've enabled. And, you know, we really do need to take our sidelines back and provide also young referees who are often children and are learning themselves, you know, with a more enjoyable game day experience.
Rick, how do we fix the underlying structures and what seems like the perverse incentives here? Because I can't imagine we're going to convince colleges to stop offering admissions preference and scholarships for certain sports. So if that is the case, is there any way to sort of break the growth of what I believe has become like a $19 billion youth sports industry? Can we somehow move away from the AAU circuit and the travel teams? Is there anything we can do structurally to change this, Rick?
Well, in addition to the things that Sky was mentioning in terms of educating people, that has to occur at the individual and personal level. structurally speaking, colleges and universities are starting to see that this model of offering or depending on youth athletes to fill their classes is just, it's not, as I mentioned before, it's just not sustainable. The numbers aren't there. The costs are going up. The whole college sports landscape is changing right now, and that's going to have long-term consequences on schools' ability to use sports and provide this kind of backdoor priority admissions process, because they're just going to be running out of money. They're going to be running out of resources. They need, and even scholarships aside, the recruitment process, even for small, what we call Division III colleges, is quite astounding, the amount of money that they spend recruiting athletes. If one of the propositions I'm making with a colleague of mine is that we move at the college level to doing tryouts like you would have at the high school and junior high school and youth level, instead of having this recruitment process, which taps into this $19 billion industry that is biased toward people with more resources who can actually access these privatized youth sports outlets. So it's going to be tough. Colleges are, ironically, higher education is very conservative. It's very resistant to change. They latch upon these models, and they're reluctant to try new things for fear of failure.
Yeah, and I want to jump in here and ask you, Sky, as a mom, as a former professional athlete, and talk about, Rick mentioned the cost, but it's a big cost to parents too, to raise a college level athlete. I mean, it's a big investment from a very young age and through the years. How much does it cost, and what does this cost do to the pool of athletes that's available to even attend some of these colleges?
Yeah, I think the first thing that we need to say is, yet absolutely, it's too expensive for the majority of players, because what's happening is that the majority of players that are playing at these high level, that get sucked into this high level pay to play, that are playing upwards of $3,000 to $20,000 a year to play youth sports, most of that being travel expenses with national leagues across our large country. But kids that are getting sucked into this are actually not going to be able to play at the college level. They don't have the potential or the athletic ability to be able to do that, but they're getting sucked in with all of these other kids, some of who do have the potential to play. And so I do think that what we're dealing with is in large part a structural issue. It's putting a lot of pressure on families. It's putting a lot of undue stress on children who are feeling the pressure that their families are paying or are feeling because of the amount that they're paying for these experiences. And so this is going to require a culture change and is going to require structural change in order to really improve the environment for children, so that kids are receiving the athletic experience that is best suited to them and to their athletic potential and their mental perceptions and abilities towards sport.
And Rick, did you want to comment on that, the cost to individual families to raise athletes?
Yeah, I think Sky hit it on the head there. It's prohibitive in some sports more than others, soccer being kind of in the middle, but a sport like ice hockey could easily cost between $15,000 and $20,000 a year. And the recreational options for kids in various sports that don't cost a lot of money are drying up. And one of the reasons is that the privatized youth sports industry is kind of taking over the field space, and towns and schools are granting them because it's a moneymaker for the towns and the schools, as opposed to just opening up for the local recreational league for kids to come and play, and for volunteers to referee if need be, and volunteers to coach. Those kinds of options are dropping out. And as Guy said, the kids are dropping out too at phenomenal rates. And the number one reason they list for dropping out of sports is that they're not having fun.
Sky, I bet there are some people listening who are hearing this and saying, look, we got to be tough on kids. That's how they grow. Tough love. That's how I came up. That's how I became good at sport X or sport Y. Is that completely misguided? Or what would you say to someone who believes that there is real constructive value in tough parenting and tough coaching?
You know, I appreciate that there are different parenting styles and there are different ways that certain athletes respond. And I heard a quote this morning that sport teaches what we make it teach. Mm-hmm. So if we make teach sport stress, anxiety, unbalanced view on being perfect or an obedience, like you were talking about, an obedience to adults, that's what it will teach us. And if, on the flip side, we make it teach lessons and teamwork and solidarity and friendship and community building, then that's what it will teach as well. So to the parents and to the coaches who believe that this is the way it has to be, that we have to put this undue pressure on children, I often say, is it working? You know, is that path working for you? And how are the children on your team feeling? When we ask kids and we survey children about what they want, the responses are very clear. Kids want to have fun. They want to be in coaching environments in which coaches support them.
Yeah. And so we'll have to leave it there. Sky Eddy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Rick Eckstein, thank you for joining us as well.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
Coming up next on Studio 2, we are going to calm ourselves down a little with some meditation. Producer Paige Marie Bessler takes us to a Buddhist meditation class coming up.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. I like those beats there, Avi.
Very meditative.
You know, you're very meditative, you know. I will say This is a new show, so it's been a lot. Like, you know, it's stress inducing to start something new.
Although it's been a lot
of fun too, but it is a lot of stress.
Yep.
And you have a new baby on top of it.
I do.
How do you deal with your stress?
Not well. I mean, I don't really have a method for it. I like to say that, you know, I like to watch sports. That's like one of my hobbies. I don't know if that really reduces stress though. I would say my answer to that is I don't have a like comprehensive way of dealing with my stress, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Well, I used to be very stressed out, have anxiety, and I started a meditation practice about 6 years ago.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I do it daily, every morning before I come in, 20 minutes to clear my mind.
I'm learning something
about
you,
Sherry. You're wondering why I'm like always very
so
cheerful.
Zen. Yeah, you are.
But meditation, it sort of clears your mind. It can lower your blood pressure. There's so many wonderful things about it.
And so our producer, Paige Marie Bessler, wanted to teach us a little something about meditation and try it herself. She went to the Kadampa Meditation Center in Philadelphia, and this was her experience.
I think most people who've heard about the practice of meditation or tried it once or twice themselves at home have an idea about what it actually looks like to meditate, what it actually means to sit in your thoughts, to take deep breaths. And then there are the apps, the popular one on TV that plays this sound. And the screen says, breathe deeply for 30 seconds, something like that. I know it could have personal benefits. I've heard many times that I should try it, but meditation is intimidating. What does it say about me if I can't sit still? Or maybe, like some other people, I like distraction. For Studio 2, and just in the spirit of trying something new, I traveled a very short few blocks to Kadampa Meditation Center in Old City, Philadelphia, for a morning meditation. The space is really nice. There aren't really any cheesy motivational posters, which I was afraid of, but there is a little library of books you can take home and trade to learn more about meditation. There are tan chairs and pillows on the ground. It's very tan, which added to the aspect of serenity. Also, you have to take your shoes off. There's a small mic for the teacher to talk into so everybody can hear him as he leads. His name is John, and after instructing us on how to get more comfortable, our meditation opened with a song.
O Blessed One, Shakyamuni Buddha, precious treasury of compassion, bestow our
This was a little unexpected. I honestly forgot that meditation comes directly from Buddhist practice, but the gold shrine behind the very tan chairs was a reminder, and so was this liberating prayer at the top of the session.
Ah, the source of happiness and goodness.
I would say that Buddhism was the framework for the practice. It was in the music, it's in most of the books, and not in a way that made me uncomfortable as someone who does not practice Buddhism. But the actual meditations were practical and totally secular.
Cool sensation as you breathe in, and the warmer as you breathe out.
That's John kind of helping us settle into the theme of today's meditation, which is the idea of patient acceptance. Something happens to you, maybe small things like someone makes an unnecessary comment at work or at school, or your kids are not behaving in the grocery store, or you've been on the phone with some government agency for entirely too long. This patient acceptance lesson was about not having an immediate reaction to what's going on, sort of noticing what it is, taking it in but not too much, and accepting it. Here's so John.
You realize that you need the people around you actually to train your mind. Quite amazing. Wouldn't that be amazing? You know, somebody's like yelling at you and you're like, inside you're like, thank you. This is good practice for me. And then somebody yelled at you in a while. So
and you can hear that people are laughing. A lot of this was participatory. Another surprise. And the lesson was so practical. I can relate, and you probably can too, to the very human urge to have some sort of knee-jerk reaction to something.
I was already thinking of a couple of work situations that I had this week where I'm like, oh, I could have handled that differently, put into practice this idea of patient acceptance. So,
that's Eve Miller. She's the education program coordinator at the center. She's been practicing for more than 25 years. I thought, because of that, she was a good person to ask about that feeling of, I can't sit still.
I would say we're out in the world, we're like social media, TV, distractions. It's a practice, it's like mental muscle that you build. You build your powers of concentration through practicing concentration, and that means losing concentration and finding it again.
And everyone was very kind. They're almost entirely volunteers, all very welcoming during my first and only time here, so much so that I had to ask about it.
Everyone is, and everywhere you go, all over the world when you go to these centers, everyone is like that. Pretty much everything is about not harming anyone, not doing no harm to anybody, any living thing. So it's amazing.
That's Karen Swisicki. She meditates, but she also holds down the desk near the entrance so people can check in. And these friendly people, knowingly or unknowingly adhering to Buddhist tradition in this way, they hung out afterwards. Snacks, a lot of chatting about the lesson and probably other subjects too. And one of the final classmates, I can say, was Fred, who came to Philadelphia from Nottingham in the UK.
Meditation has saved my life many times. Any negative tendencies just completely vanished by seeing all the possibilities that life offers when you have a peaceful and open mind.
He made a pretty good case for meditation, and I thought he put it in a funny way.
Even if you go to college, you probably won't learn how to be happy. But when you come here, you actually learn how to be content.
That turned out to be quite meaningful. The pressure to be a goal-oriented person, to make money, to be formally educated, a lot of that has nothing to do with how content we are. If we could give people advice or information to those who maybe wanted to try it, what would he say?
Meditation is much like learning how to play an instrument. The more you practice it, the better you get at it. And it's more fun to do it with other people because it makes it even easier to maintain a peaceful state of mind because you see other people are doing it and that gives you that extra bit of motivation.
I can't say I felt calmer the rest of the day because of the meditating, maybe just a generally even mood since I spent the morning connecting with people at Kadampa. People I met there say it's life-changing to be committed to practicing meditation. But even just trying it once, without expectations, I think can help you overcome that hurdle of, I can't sit still or I won't like it. I don't know how soon, but I will go back.
I'm so glad to hear Paige talk about this. I'm telling you, Avi, if I didn't convince you that meditation has wonderful benefits, I hope that Paige did and that you use it to de-stress your life.
Tell you what, Paige just signed herself up for more stories. That was too
that
good.
That was wonderful.
I might need some meditation before the Sixers-Celtics game tonight, Cherry, because I'm nervous about that. And by the way, newly minted league MVP Joel Embiid may play tonight.
Yeah, fingers crossed they are optimistic. Congratulations to the one and
the
only.
The MVP, my favorite basketball player of all time. No cap.
Oh, that's so sweet. That's so sweet. Well, to end it on a high note and a calming high note at that, that is it for us on Studio 2. For more of our show, head on over to WHYY.org/Studio 2 and follow WHYY on Twitter. We use the hashtag Studio 2.
Our producers are Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Our engineer is Diana Martinez from Studio 2 in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thanks for joining us.